Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA Washington correspondent Jeff Selden. Our topic on this edition of the program, the status of the nuclear deal with Iran. Our guest, Trita Parsi, an award-winning author and founder of the National Iranian American Council. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the interests of the Iranian American community. We spoke with Trita Parsi back in 2012 after the publication of his book, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. In it, he assesses the diplomatic efforts between Washington and Tehran during President Obama's first 3 years in office. Since then, the political landscape has changed in Iran. Last June, Iranians elected the pragmatic Hassan Rouhani as president, replacing the controversial Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who not only alienated the West, but also mismanaged the economy. Rouhani promised to allow greater freedom of expression and to improve the economy, in part by easing international sanctions. His election led to a six-month renewable nuclear deal with the so-called P5+1 group that suspended some of Iran's most sensitive uranium enrichment activities in exchange for minor relief from sanctions. European Union Foreign Policy Chief Catherine Ashton just returned from her trip to Tehran, where she met with Iran's top officials to discuss ongoing nuclear talks. She expressed optimism that world powers can reach a permanent deal with Iran over its nuclear ambitions, but she cautioned that success is far from certain. Talks with the P5+1 are set to resume in Vienna on March 18th. Well, we'll talk with Trita Parsi about the latest developments regarding nuclear talks with Iran and much more. Trita Parsi, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm delighted to welcome for the first time on the show my colleague Jeff Selden.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Well, Trita Parsi, we enjoyed having you in 2012. We talked to you about your book at that time just published, A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. And in it, you implied that President Obama made a good faith effort at negotiations early in his first term, but didn't go quite far enough. Do you think he has a second chance now with his interim nuclear deal?
There is a second chance, very much because of what happened in the Iranian elections with Rouhani coming to power. And the determination of the administration towards making sure that this negotiation actually succeeds is remarkable, I have to say. This is not at all the determination that they had in 2009, and certainly not what they had in 2010 and beyond. The political insulation of the process, the willingness of the president to spend political capital to protect it and to advance it is unprecedented and very impressive.
Now, as I said in the introduction, Catherine Ashton, the EU foreign policy chief, was just in Tehran. She expressed cautious optimism but said we are far from concluding some kind of a permanent deal. There are many sticking points. How would you assess progress or lack thereof so far, and what are the major sticking points?
Well, progress so far has been, again, quite impressive. For instance, in the last session in Vienna, in the first round of talks for the second phase or for the final phase, what you had there was that over the course of 2.5 days, the two sides agreed on every point that should be on the agenda, and they scheduled 4 additional rounds of talks, and they already decided the venue. Before, just scheduling 1 round of talks and deciding the time and deciding the venue used to take a full day. But now, they're much more on the same page. There is a common interest on both sides towards advancing as fast as possible because this is a rush against the clock. They don't have all the time in the world. So far, yes, a lot of progress, and we have to recognize that this is quite different from what it used to be. But there are significant differences remaining. Everything from how much the Iranians have to walk back their program during the final phase of this to how and when and at what point the U.S. can lift some of the sanctions that it has to lift in order to get a deal, and then to make sure that the various steps are synchronized in such a way that neither side feels that they're getting the lesser end of the bargain, because this is very important to understand. either both sides have to feel that this has been a success for them and that there's something valuable for them in it, or this whole thing falls apart. There's not going to be a deal in which one side is a loser and the other side is a winner. Both sides will have to feel that they won something. And incidentally, both sides will also lose some things, because now it's really about what are you willing to offer, what compromises are you willing to give, and what compromises are you willing to absorb.
And we know that there are, of course, detractors both in the United States and inside Iran who would like to scuttle the deal, but we'll get to that in a moment. Let me turn to my colleague Jeff Selden for a question.
One of the things that jumps out at me is all the talk about, initially with President Rouhani coming to power, the Iranian charm offensive. And we still see that to some extent, lots of handshakes, trips by especially the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, but also President Rouhani, handshakes, smiles, an attempt to reach out, but that's also met with some backlash. How is that playing in Iran, and specifically with the critical parties? You have the hardliners who will be opposed to everything, most likely, but with the people who elected Rouhani and put him in power, how are they receiving the changes he's been able to put in place and the concessions he's been able to get so far, even though it's still overall early on in these negotiations?
Look, there's going to be a very, very tricky thing for the Iranians in order to be able to go forward with this, because just as much as there are elements in the United States that seem to prefer to keep the sanctions and prefer to essentially have permanent sanctions on Iran and see what potentially could come out of that, there are also those in Iran that are very worried about any type of opening with Iran. They're very much opposed to it for strategic, ideological, political reasons.
Opening to the United States.
Opening to the United States. And they have turned some of these issues of the nuclear file into much bigger issues than they really are. It's when you kind of confuse what is an end and what is a mean. And they have been put on the defensive as a result of the elections. And they're very worried that if Rouhani actually succeeds, the setback that they suffered in the elections may actually become a permanent political setback. That conservatives will actually end up being marginalized, not just for the next election period, but for a much longer period of time. And as a result, they're going to put forward a lot of resistance to this. But mindful of that, we have to have a recognition of the fact that it's not going to be easy to make changes for the Iranians. The shift that they're doing is, to a large extent, very similar to the shift that the U.S. is doing. The president is facing a lot of resistance from whole sets of different actors within the U.S. and as well as from allies in the region. There are benefactors of every status quo. And the status quo between the United States and Iran, this enmity, this what I call institutionalized enmity in the book, has been going on for 35 years. Nothing goes on for 35 years unless someone is benefiting. And those elements on both sides are going to try to make everything as difficult as possible going forward. That means that it's going to be tricky and time-intensive and time-consuming for Rouhani to be able to fully shift it. So obviously, it's going to start off with a tweet, a few handshakes. It cannot start off with massive substance right away. Having said that, however, let's also recognize the substance that has been given so far. The Iranians agreeing to the interim deal has led to a situation in which Iran, for the first time now in a year, has less 20% enriched uranium than is needed for having a bomb. Prior to this deal, before they started to diluting the 20% stockpile, they had enough 20% so that they potentially could build a bomb if they so chose. Now they don't even have the material to do so. That's a very substantive achievement that goes well beyond charm offensive, handshakes, or photo ops.
Nonetheless, of course, there are major concerns on the part of Israel and Saudi Arabia. We saw Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington recently, President Obama trying to assuage his concerns. For him, the prospect of Iran enriching uranium at all, even for civilian purposes, is absolutely a red line. How are the P5 plus one in Iran going to sort of finagle that particular element? Because we know that Iran, at least rhetorically, says that they feel they have the right to enrich uranium.
That issue is already dealt with and done with. The interim agreement makes it very clear that Iran is going to have enrichment on its own soil, And it will continue to have so not only during this interim period, it will have so during the final phase, and it will have it during the post-final phase era. That is quite clear from the text. It talks about how the two sides are going to come to an agreement for the final phase for a mutually agreed size of the enrichment program. And then after the final phase, once everything has been resolved and both sides have lived up to their agreement, Iran will become a normal NPT power, meaning that there's no restrictions on the Iranian nuclear program beyond the restrictions that Japan, Brazil, Sweden, Belgium face as normal NPT countries. Because, and this is very critical, if Iran answers all questions and restores the confidence of the international community, then it has to become a normal state. It cannot permanently be punished, even though it comes clean. So Israel has lost that battle of trying to push things back to zero enrichment, unless, of course, the deal falls apart. But I think also from the Israeli perspective, it is not just about zero enrichment. It's about making sure that if Iran is going to win the confidence of the international community and come back in from the cold, Israel wants the compromises Iran has to agree to not to just be about the nuclear program, also about its attitude towards the Israeli state. And I think that is fully understandable. And if you're sitting in Israel, of course, that's what you're going to be pushing for. The problem, however, is that Israel has not really pushed for that, at least not explicitly, but rather has been pushing for objectives for the nuclear deal that are impossible to achieve, which then ensures that the deal is not achieved. Instead of going forward and say, we're okay with this deal, we agree to it, but we want these other things. Please take our concerns into consideration. Part of the reason why it's been difficult for the P5+1 to take Israeli concerns into consideration more than they have already is because there's not a sense that the Israelis actually want a deal to succeed. And many people inside of Israel have gone on the record, senior people saying this was a mistake. Israel should have played its cards differently.
There are a lot of people, not just in Israel, who say you simply cannot trust Iran, that whatever agreements that are made, whatever Iranian negotiators say that Iran will do, Tehran will agree to, that Iran simply won't live up to it, that Iran is simply trying to buy time. And you mentioned earlier that to move ahead, eventually Iran will have to answer questions about security and verification. But given the doubt that exists in Israel, in Saudi Arabia, among lots of lawmakers in the U.S., how easy is it going to be, and how will Iran find a way to answer some of those questions and prove that after so many years, decades of mistrust, that now it can be trusted?
I think that's a very important question. I think it's also important to remind ourselves from the outset of this that trust is a two-way street. The Iranians deeply mistrust the West, and they have good reasons to do so, just as much as the West deeply mistrusts Iran and also has good reasons to do so. This has not been a one-sided conflict. This has been a two-sided conflict in which both sides have done things to the other side that have been quite negative. The beauty of the deal, however, is that it doesn't force either side to put faith or trust into the other side. You put faith into the mechanisms of implementation, verification, and inspection of the deal itself. The deal will monitor and ensure that both sides are playing it fair and living up to their agreements. That's what you have to trust, because it would be much more dangerous if you had to put trust in the other side when there is no trust. You put trust in the mechanisms of the deal to ensure that if the other side cheats, you find out very quickly. So far, neither side has cheated. The IAEA report has verified that the Iranians have diluted the 20% stockpile to the extent that they need to. Everything that has been agreed upon, and there's been hard deadlines, so far have been met without any delays. And it's the IAEA, an independent body, that verifies this. And that's critical, because that's what's enabling two sides that don't trust each other to still be able to have a deal.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Trita Parsi. He's the founder of the National Iranian American Council. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to advancing the interests of the Iranian American community, and the author of A Single Roll of the Dice, Obama's Diplomacy with Iran. And I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA Washington correspondent Jeff Selden. This is a reminder that Press Conference USA is also available online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. And as always, we love to hear from you. So please send an email with your feedback to pcusa@voanews.com. Well, back to you, Trita Parsi. And speaking of those other elements of Iran's behavior, whether it's the support for terrorism, its support of the regime of Bashar al-Assad, or other human rights violations, to what extent should those factors be considered in the context of these nuclear negotiations?
The P5 plus one have made a decision that the negotiations are just about the nuclear issue. And there's many different reasons for this. Iran's support for Assad, however objectionable that may be, is not a position that is opposed by Russia and China. On the contrary, they're equally, if not even more, supportive of this. So you're not going to have a consensus amongst the P5 plus one on that issue. Similarly, frankly, on almost every other issue, whether it is support for Hezbollah, involvement in Iraq and Afghanistan, human rights, etc., the only issue you're actually going to have some sort of a consensus between the P5 plus one vis-a-vis Iran is the nuclear issue. I personally believe, however, that the nuclear issue ultimately is a symptom of a much larger problem. And that is a geopolitical contest between Iran and the United States, in which neither side is going to win. Both sides need to compromise. In order to make the deal sustainable, in my personal view, you have to broaden the agenda at some point. In my view, much earlier than what the administration is pushing for right now. This does not have to be part of the P5 plus one discussions, but rather a side conversation between the United States and Iran, because there already are bilateral talks, and I see no reason as to why the agenda for those talks cannot be expanded, should not be expanded, and in my view, they should definitely include human rights as well. I sense from the administration side that there's a lot of sensitivity on this issue. They don't want to do anything that would give Iranian hardliners an excuse to try to sabotage the talks even further than they already are. And I understand that logic. But at the same time, there's another logic that also has to be taken into consideration, which is unless there is a broader agreement, how confident can we be that the nuclear agreement in and of itself will not fall apart and that it actually will be sustainable? Because if the US and Iran go back to the same enmity that they have today, but they have a nuclear agreement, that enmity becomes a threat to that nuclear agreement.
That's a very good point. In terms of human rights, another analyst, Ray Takei, based here in Washington, says that the United States should actually openly push for greater human rights. And we saw a report recently by UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon saying that President Rouhani has failed thus far to keep his campaign promise to allow greater freedom of expression, and that there has been a sharp rise, for example, in executions since his election. How do you see that?
There has been a sharp rise in executions, and that is extremely unfortunate, and I think the international community should take these issues seriously. I think it is fair to say that the nuclear issue has completely dominated the agenda in such a way that it's actually come at the expense of other issues. But at the same time, it's also important to understand what is happening inside of Iran and why you're having these very negative developments on the human rights front. As I read it, what you're seeing right now is a situation in which hardliners in Iran who are opposed to what Rouhani is doing, more than anything else for political reasons, have been prevented from attacking the nuclear deal directly because Rouhani has the protection of Khamenei, Iran's supreme leader, on that issue. So instead, they are forced to attack Rouhani on a whole set of other issues. One thing Rouhani does not control is the Iranian judiciary. It is the Iranian judiciary that is responsible for these executions. The head of the Iranian judiciary is a gentleman called Sadeq Larijani. His brother is another conservative who's head of the parliament. If Rouhani is successful in the next parliamentary election, up to 60-70% of the current parliamentarians are going to lose their seat because the current parliament is a conservative-dominated parliament from the era of Ahmadinejad. And Larijani himself will most likely lose his speakership. They have an interest in making sure that Rouhani is not successful. Now, they can't attack him on the nuclear issue, at least not right now. And it appears that they have shifted towards human rights because if you increase the human rights violations in Iran, two things will happen. A, the outside world, Europe in particular, may lose confidence and appetite for negotiations and a deal with Iran, which in and of itself then can sabotage the deal and then the conservatives win. The second thing that may happen is that Rouhani may take on the conservatives directly on the human rights issue. And so far, he has not, at least not directly. And that would then drag Rouhani into a two-front war with the conservatives, one in which he has the protection of Khamenei, and one in which he certainly does not have the protection of Khamenei. It seems like so far, Rouhani's strategy has been to just stick to the nuclear issue, hope that he gets that to succeed as quickly as possible, and then he will have much more political capital to take on the conservatives on all other issues. And I'm not saying this is the right or wrong strategy, but in the meantime, unfortunately, that will mean that there will be more human rights abuses in Iran without Rouhani doing something visible and directly about it. And that is going to cause a lot of disconcern amongst a lot of people who voted for Rouhani, who voted for him because they wanted him to address these issues. He promised to break the securitized atmosphere in Iran. He rallied people who had supported the Green Movement in 2009. And this is their top agenda point. And I think it's a very, very risky thing, but his options don't seem to be particularly attractive.
And so what I hear you saying is that the United States would do well to push those issues to show the population in Iran who would like to see those changes, that the U.S. is on that side and is vocally supportive of greater human rights, internet freedom, and so forth.
The United States must have several different objectives, and sometimes they, in the short term, can be in contradiction with each other. On the one hand, absolutely, the United States wants the people of Iran to know that it's on the side of human rights. Now, the United States, I have to be frank, is going to have some difficulties convincing the population of that because of a lot of things that have happened in the region and continues to happen. And this is a very skeptical population, not just against its own government and the policies of the Iranian government, but also of the policies of the United States. It's a population that tends to be very positively inclined towards the U.S. as a country, as a culture, as a people, not necessarily towards its foreign policy. But at the same time, the U.S., and particularly the Obama administration, have a very clear interest in making sure that the nuclear negotiations are successful. And I think what is needed to be done is to find a formula in which, rather than these two issues ending up in some sort of a fabricated competition with each other, to find a formula in which actually there is synergy between them. That nuclear negotiations help human rights also help the nuclear negotiations. I'm not sure that formula has been found yet, but I'm confident that there's a way to be able to bridge the two.
How dangerous a game are the hardliners, both in Iran and in the United States, playing with these negotiations? It seems that there is a great sensitivity on the part of both Iran and the U.S. to who's winning, who's coming out on top, who's not looking like the loser. Is there an understanding on the opposite sides of what's at stake and the internal games that are going on, the eternal political fighting and battling? There was a lot made of whether or not the U.S. Senate should vote for more sanctions. Do the Iranian negotiators have a sense of how that played out and why that played out the way it did in the United States? And do you think the United States has the same understanding of some of what we've been talking about in terms of the hardliners in Iran and the games they're playing in terms of their struggle for power with President Rouhani?
I think that's a great question. And I would say that my own reading is that the Iranians understand and have a way of following what's happening inside of the U.S. a bit better then the U.S. can follow what's happening in Iran. And there's some very natural and obvious reasons for that. First of all, the U.S. is an open society. You can read an open press here, and you can easily see a variety of viewpoints, and that gives you a decent understanding of what's taking place. Iran is not an open society. The press is not open. In fact, in spite of Rouhani coming to power, there's still significant problems, and in fact, not a lot that has been done to improve it. So there's a lot happening in Iran that is not coming out in the open. Moreover, most of these Iranian top leaders in Rouhani's government have either had experience working in the U.S. or have degrees from major universities in the U.S. Rouhani himself studied in England. There's not a single cabinet minister in the Obama administration, to the best of my knowledge, that have a degree from Tehran University. So the understanding of what's happening in Iran, for understandable reasons, is much, much weaker. So, for instance, I think the Iranians understood quite well what was happening in the Senate and why it was happening the way it was. And I think they must have ended up being quite impressed that Obama won that issue, mindful of the fact that he's not won a lot of issues in the U.S. Senate or in the U.S. Congress as of late. But then we have the very interesting question about what's happening with human rights in Iran right now. I have a sense that people in the White House do understand these issues. but it's not sipping through to the broader political elite in the United States, in which there is a more direct and immediate understanding of why you're seeing this very, very negative and objectionable development in the human rights situation under Rouhani, a person who promised the exact opposite.
Well, hopefully people will be listening to our interview and they'll have a better understanding. Trita Parsi, what about the crisis over Ukraine? To what extent will this crisis, which has strained relations between Washington and Moscow, endanger essential Russian cooperation on Iran?
It's very tricky to be able to predict how this is going to affect the negotiations. So far, one has to say that prior Russian-American crises, and of course, none of them were as tricky as this one or as deep as this one, nevertheless did not impact the nuclear negotiations. The U.S. and Russia were mature and sophisticated enough in order to be able to limit and isolate their conflict so that it would not spill over into the nuclear negotiations. That may still happen, and I think that would be a good thing. I think it would be dangerous to see if the Iranians get a temptation of thinking that they now can play the U.S. against Russia in the negotiations, because I think that could cause more difficulties than positive things. And you can also have a very simple problem, which is that the U.S. and Russia within the P5 cannot come to a conclusion or a common position, which then would delay the talks. But the talks cannot be afforded to be delayed because time is limited. And that in of itself could be a major threat to the negotiations.
Well, on that rather dubious note, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of Press Conference USA. Trita Parsi, we want to thank you so much for coming in and sharing
your
terrific insights. Trita Parsi is an award-winning author, and he's founder of the National Iranian American Council. Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Sidrak Franklin. And joining me on the program was VOA Washington correspondent Jeff Selden. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.